Let me get some sound.
More sound, please, Pippin. Yes, talk. Talk, Pippin. Come on, you can talk. There you go. There you go. Oh, yes, you can. He comes and pushes your arm like this when he wants to talk. He's still chattering away.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me the story of Pippin. How did you meet Pippin?
It was a surprise from, I think Fernanda had a hand in it, and certainly Lee did. I didn't even know they were plotting or thinking about a dog. Just one day Lee said, we're going to drive to the north. He really didn't tell me why we were heading up to the next state north of us. And when we got close to it, he started looking around for a certain lady, and I was wondering what it was all about. Finally, he said, well, there will be a lady and a dog. And so that was when I first met Pippin.
Was Pippin part of a group of puppies, or was Pippin the only one waiting for you?
Pippin was the only one there. She raised a lot of Aussies, and I think the others in the litter had been all taken, and he was the last to go. He was still a puppy, all fluffy puppy.
I remember Pippin, when he first came here, he looked like a stuffed toy at Grand Rabbit's. He was a little brown dog with white eyebrows, and he was about the size of a medium-sized cat and fluffier than any dog I'd ever seen.
That is true. He was very, very fluffy, and he's not as fluffy as he used to be. He was a ball of fur.
How old is Pippin now?
Pippin's birthday is at December, right, 1st of January, and he's as old as the year, so now he's 12.
So 12 years ago, you got to meet Pippin.
Right.
How did you choose his name?
Well, I think the family picked the name. I really didn't pick a special name for him. Pippin was hungry, always liked to be fed, so that reminded people of the Pippin in the story of The Hobbit, because if you remember, he would always be asking for second meals and this meal in between that meal, and he was always eating. So Pippin seemed to be a good name for a hungry dog.
Well, The Hobbit, a lot of others in the family have always liked.
Oh, yes. Most of you read it more than once, and I was trying to remember how old you all were when The Hobbits first came out. I think you were probably still in grade school or in just junior high, but A Hobbit was made a big impact on all the family.
You know, I remember first noticing it at the Great Bend Public Library, just looking for books over the summer one time, and it had the most interesting name of any book on the shelf. I mean, how many books are called The Hobbit?
Well, that got your attention, and that was important. I was trying to remember if it was the book. Chase was not liking school. He was not liking all the assignments at school, at Shady Grove Country School, and reading was very hard for him. In fact, you were in college. You came home from college, and you said he's just bored with what he's trying to read, and he should have, was it The Hobbit or the one before that? It was some very, very interesting book like The Hobbit. Once he started on that, he was reading constantly, and he read it three times, I think.
We'd have to ask Chase whether it was The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings.
I think it was The Lord of the Rings. It was a hard book to read for that age. Boy, it was probably what got him over the hurdle of not wanting to read and not trying to read.
And recently, Chase sent an email saying that his son, Eamon Lee, has some thoughts from The Hobbit, too, that have to do with when to have breakfast and when to have lunch and what to have in between.
Well, that goes with the age when they're growing fast and hungry all the time.
Eamon Lee told his mom, Betty, I'd like to have a preview of my lunch before I go to school.
That's a good catchphrase. I think that would be a good description of it.
Well, what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I really don't have a topic. If you have some questions you want to ask, we'll go from there.
Well, what book do you remember reading when you were a girl? What were some of the books that stood out for you?
Well, I can remember when I was quite young, before I started school, that I was delighted when my mother wanted to go visit her friend from Ireland. And this is the only person that I had ever seen that had a whole set of encyclopedias. And whenever I would go there, the women would talk, and I would sit down and go through the encyclopedias. I don't know that I was reading them, because I don't think I was in school yet. But I was enjoying them, certainly.
Well, you know, encyclopedias were like a magazine or the internet. They had pictures in them.
Not the kind of pictures we have now. They had every so often a hand-drawn illustration, very few photographs. It just was unusual. You could see animals, and you can see all kinds of things. Pippin just opened the door. He's putting himself out. See, can you see this? He just pulls the door open, and then he can push it. And he can't get quite around there because your chair is in the way.
Well, I'll move my chair then.
There you go. I'm going out. There you go. Thank you, but now it's all cold. See, the cold air is coming in. I did not ever teach him to open the doors, but I like to teach him to close the doors, because there are times I come home from some meeting and he has opened the doors and I have no idea what other animals might be in the house.
Has there ever been an animal in the house?
Well, yes, there was a deer right about where you're sitting in the house.
Where am I sitting?
You're sitting very near the kitchen. It was obvious that a deer came into the house and walked up to the counter, because deer are not housebroken. And so that's the evidence that there was a deer in the house.
So you found a whole bunch of what looked like licorice chocolate drops.
Well, yes, I found evidence the deer was there, yes. So I'm not sure what the deer was going to munch on, but I get a little more careful about trying to keep doors closed. But when I lock them, Pippin can unlock them, you know. And you see the wooden dowels over there. I've had to put in all the slide-open doors, the little round white thing over there. That's one thing he hasn't learned, to take it out of the bottom so the door can't open. So that's been helping somewhat. But then he tried to then dig under the door here and destroyed some carpet. So he had not given up, even because in any way he still thinks he can get out whenever he wants to.
Well, to get out of these sliding glass doors, he has to unlock them. He has to push up the latch. And then I just saw him. He grabs the handle in his teeth, and he pulls and pulls.
Oh, yes. He's very skillful. It takes him about 2 minutes, and he's out. But as I said, I need to teach him to close the door after he goes out, and he has not learned or even thought about doing that.
What was the first dog that you had?
Oh, that was a very long time ago. Gypsy. Gypsy was a little dog that adopted us, a very small dog, about the size of a cat, but a little bit heavier, and a short-haired kind of terrier. I must have been all of about four. Gypsy was with us probably for about 5 years, I think. She was old when she came.
I think that you have a bald eagle flying right there.
It comes and sits right over in this cottonwood tree over here. And at least it's a very large bird. I'm not sure it's an eagle, because it doesn't have that curved beak. The one that sits over here looks, I don't know how to describe it. It's a big, dark-colored bird, as big as an eagle.
You know, if it has kind of wispy wings, it might be a turkey vulture, because they're around here too. But if its wings are level like a jet, you know, like an airplane, mm-hmm. then it probably is an eagle, if it's got very clean, kind of squared-off wings.
Well, we have a lot of critters around here, no doubt.
Well, sorry about that, but that just happened. So Gypsy was your first dog. And at 4 years old, did Gypsy make a big impression on you?
A child always likes to have a pet. And she more or less adopted us, and would hang around the house. And finally, she was allowed to come in. So she convinced us that we could have a dog in the house.
Now, how did that go? Were your mom and dad both okay about having a dog? Had you ever had a pet before?
No, I don't think we ever had pets. I was older when we got the cats, and Gypsy was the dog that we had first. And I think, of course, we probably were the ones that were that got her into the house because the parents, of course, did not want the dog in the house. She was very short-haired, so in wintertime you almost had to put the dog in the house.
All right, so you and your brother Paul conspired together to persuade your parents that this little dog that was hanging out could be your dog.
I'm not at all sure that Paul liked the dog or was with the dog. I don't remember that. I'd have to ask him.
It was you and your friends then, that you and your four-year-old friends?
4 years old, I didn't have a lot of play friends over at my cousin Barbara, who was my same age, who lived just a block away. I think she had a dog about that time. Her dog had been with her before Gypsy got to us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so Barbara set the family precedent.
Well, I think she's thought she did, at least. She still would like to.
Well, so do you remember Gypsy being a dog that was nice to you or that everybody in the family liked as she settled in?
The Gypsy was old enough she didn't chew on things, so you didn't have trouble with the chewing up of toys and chewing up of dolls and things. So I think it went very well. In fact, even when we got the cats, then later, the kittens, it was Nip and Tuck, and I had Tuck, only I called him Tucker. And he was a yellow cat, about the size of your big yellow cat.
He was about the size of Andy then,
yes,
our
Andy.
Big yellow cat. Now, how old were you when you got a cat?
I don't remember precisely, but it was after the dog had been around for a while.
So you were still a little kid?
Oh, yes. Yes, well before grade school.
Mm-hmm. Well, that means that your dog, Gypsy, kind of paved the way for other pets.
Yes, however, we liked all kinds of other people's pets, so I think in the neighborhood, as you go walking out and around, you would have fun giving a pat to the neighbor's dogs, too. And there was a bulldog right next door, and of course, bulldogs make this wonderful commotion at your door when they come up. They're snorting, and they can't help it. It's their face. They make all these funny little noises. That bulldog was over about half the time, and I think that my parents were not at all pleased with the bulldog being there all that time.
Well, so you had an adopted dog, Gypsy, and Gypsy had a friend who was a bulldog who liked to come over and visit you all. Mm-hmm. The bulldog was kind of half your dog. Mm-hmm. And then how about kittens? Now, kittens are more of a commitment. How did the kittens come along?
I doubt that all of that kind of information about dogs and cats are interesting as far as family members are concerned. It's kind of nice memories, but I hope everyone has those kind of nice memories of their first pets, too.
Well, are they memories that matter to you?
Well, you learn to treat them fairly, and they treat you fairly, and you need to learn that you have to keep them out of harm's way. You do learn a lot of basic information that keeps you safe, too. So it's a good learning experience. It's a nice family experience. We had a very nice side yard because when I was very small, my mother and father moved to a house in a lovely neighborhood, and then they began to improve upon it. They built a second floor level with stairs going up and put on a back music room. About 2 years later, my father decided it needed a basement. It was during the Depression, so he hired some people to help. They jacked up the house, and they dug a basement. That basement, then he turned into a recreation room.
I've seen, I think, that house maybe once. It's in Hutchinson, Kansas. Mm-hmm. It's on a very pretty street with lots of big trees and big lots, and none of the houses are huge, but they're all pretty. They have kind of a craftsman style to them. If I remember, it wasn't just any old person that helped him do this. It was his brothers and your mom's brothers and cousins. They made it into a project, improving that house to help a lot of the people they cared about.
And the side yard was like another space for another house, but they bought it rather than having houses side by side. They would get the car, and on weekends, they would go out and we would collect rocks, and we made rock gardens. One side of the house was made into many rock gardens, with some of them with pools of water, but those were filled up one time after a child was playing in the water, and it wasn't our water, it was another several blocks away. but it was very dangerous. So our ponds that they created were then filled up with sand. So we had what looked like a pond, but it wasn't really a pond. But we all gathered the rocks for all that.
That would have been heavy work for a little child.
Oh, but we all liked it because we'd find special rocks that would have a bird bath in it, or special rocks that would be flat, or special rocks that would have personality. Well, that was fun.
Well, so that was one of the happier memories of your childhood then, was going out and collecting rocks.
Well, then my father decided that with that lower level of the basement, which he'd made a glass roof on one end of it, he began to collect cactus. Because cactus, he was intrigued with. Cactus bloom at night. I would go up sometimes to get something out of the refrigerator, a drink of milk or something, and there would be the cactus, but he'd put it in the refrigerator because it's dark inside the refrigerator and the bloom would stay open. You never realized that a cactus had a lovely bloom like that unless you would stay up all night to see it happen or have it in the refrigerator.
What a surprise that'd be to see that. Well, was your mom or your dad the one who started adventures like that?
We were always included in those. Neither my mother or my father liked fishing. I had uncles that liked fishing, so we went fishing with uncles.
You told me a story once about how to catch a catfish mm-hmm. with just your hand that you stick in its mouth.
No, not its mouth. No, no. You didn't understand. A catfish has three spines. One sticks straight up above its back, and there are two that go further out than its mouth to the sides. And so when you try to pick up a catfish, you have to put your fingers down in such a way that those prongs go between your fingers, and then the back part of your hand claps on around them. And they're not hard to pick up. When they're hungry, you take bread out and put it in the water, and they're just gobbling up the bread, and they're not paying much attention to you. We rented a small sand pit that was close to town. We did some swimming, but we played with the fish. We didn't catch them. We didn't use hooks and lines. We just played with fish.
So you never ate them?
Well, I'm sure my uncles that caught fish and their wives would cook them, and if we were staying with them, we probably had some fish that they had caught, but we never did. We would go fishing with them just because of the adventure of being out by the water.
Well, that sounds like you had quite an extended family.
They were the uncles on my mother's side of the family. There were four boys and four girls. She was one of the four girls. My grandfather was in the Civil War, and when he came back from the Civil War, he went to, in Colorado, to the place that's the steel mill down south.
Pueblo, the Pueblo steel mill.
Pueblo, yeah. Well, anyway, south of here, south of Boulder. And he and his brothers did a lot of building there. I'm not sure where they gained their knowledge of building craft, but they did, and they have, according to some research Deb's done, there's an entire block that's called the Jones Block because it was built by Joneses. While he was there, he met my grandmother, Laura. And I'm named after my grandmother, Laura, L-U-R-A. She was teaching. She was a teacher in that city. After they were married, then I was trying to remember which of members of the family had others in Hutchinson, Kansas. So they came from Colorado back to Hutchinson. So that's where they all lived, in Hutchinson.
Well, that would have been really something to have that many people around who would just now and then drop by and say, let's take one of the nieces out to have a time going fishing. Let's take Betsy.
On my mother's side, they always liked to get together constantly whenever they had an opportunity. They'd get together and they'd play card games together, or they would get together and go fishing together, or they would get together and go on short trips. And her family, of the eight of them, one sister was out in California, another one was out in Colorado, but the rest of them would all get together frequently because they liked to. In fact, when they were young, their father died very, very early. The youngest one in the family was when he died. So the mother had to get a business going to support the family. and that's when she started the cement block business. So they all learned to make cement blocks and deliver cement blocks and put cement blocks into working building things. So they were all very comfortable working with rocks and mortar and that kind of thing, and never had a surplus of any kind of what you call income, but they could support their own family by that. In fact, my grandmother started a church there, and there were others, cousins, that would tell me that if there were people in the church that were hard up and needed some assistance and didn't have family, she would take them into her own family's house and boot somebody out of their bedroom and turn that over to the guest. And they said she did that time and time again. And she continued working until they were able to build a church. I think you've seen it in Hutchinson. And it's all built of stone. It's a beautiful church.
What kind of church is it?
It's a Christian Scientist church. And so on her side of the family, on my grandmother's side of the family, that goes probably back several generations, I'm not sure, but I've met cousins that had visited her and said that she was a very generous person and they enjoyed being with her for the summer. She was very active in keeping the church up and going and keeping it repaired.
Did she have much education, or did she just launch into doing these things because she got things done?
Her education had to be more extensive than her children, any of her children, because she was a teacher. I don't know that I have anything exist that I know that teachers are usually have a higher education. And because of the fact that the father died while the family was still quite young, they all worked and they all could not go probably high school, not even through high school, maybe all together. So all of them had a limited education. But all of their, when they were married and they raised their own children, all of their children went on to college. For that reason, I think they all enjoyed each other's company. In fact, my one cousin said that they would put on shows. They'd let the neighborhood know that they're going to put on an exhibition or a dance or whatever it was. And as long as they'd come and pay a penny, they could come and watch the show and see them sing and dance. And they were rather extroverts. But enjoyed seeing people and having people around.
How about your dad? Was he an extrovert?
Oh, no. On that side of the family, they're very quiet people, very quiet. My grandmother, I'd be around her for all day long, and we would visit briefly, but there was no talk. My grandfather was quite a talker, Grandfather Dillon. He loved to visit with people. But on my grandmother's side, she was very, very quiet, and I think they had 12 children. My father was the oldest boy. His sister, Bertha, was the oldest in the family, but she died when he was quite young, and it was a very hard thing for him because she was his important person in his life. So from that time on, he was the oldest member of all the rest of the children. And he finally, after taking care of about 6 of the younger children, he decided he'd go out and earn his own living when he was 12. So he more or less went out on his own at that time. And then later he went to the war, and he came back and he had finished his high school and he finished his college as an engineer by working. And so he was very, very quiet, but a lot of his brothers, except for one or two, were very, very quiet.
There's a new book out that's on the New York Times bestseller book, and you know what the title is?
No.
Quiet. And it's about the benefits of people who are introverted and how somebody who's introverted is more likely to design and create things on their own rather than as a team, and just talking about the traits of somebody like that and what their contributions tend to be.
Well, that's very definitely an description of them. They were very creative in what they did and how they did it, but they didn't like to be around groups of people where they were expected to chatter with them. They would not chatter with them.
Well, would they enjoy the chatter but just listen to it?
No, I don't think so. I think they knew enough with manners to say hello, how are you today, and all those general things, but not to get into discussions, I would say.
Well, if your mom was so outgoing and your dad was so quiet, how did they connect up?
Well, it all started with my mother's family. Her sister Rachel was working for the Dillon store in, I think, in Oklahoma. Rachel was so much of an extrovert that she was always wanting to dress the nicest and do things that with a new style, like earrings. And while they were working in the grocery store, she was told that she was not supposed to wear earrings. And she refused, and so they fired her, and they hired my mother. And that was the store where my father was working at that time. So they met because of that, because they were in the same store. He was the engineer that built and created the mechanical things that would go in the store. And so that's how they met, and they were married in Oklahoma.
Well, and so they met and they got married. How did they communicate if your mom was really an extrovert and your dad was an introvert?
Oh, it wasn't as though they never talked. They would say, if, for example, when they were recreating the whole house, the downstairs, the upstairs, and all the things about the house, it was always discussed at the dinner table, like what would be a good idea to put something in that would work in this way or that way. So the functionality of things were topics, but I don't ever think I ever heard my father talking about another person. My mother would volunteer and be very active. For example, at war times, she was a nurse aide. She was always helping during various things that they had to do during the war times. And she enjoyed visiting with people and getting to know them when she worked with them. But I think my father was not that kind that enjoyed having that kind of a conversation.
Well, it sounds like the way that they enjoyed each other's company the most was on doing projects, that they liked to get together and go find rocks for the rock garden or help design the next part of what was going to happen with the house.
They liked to take trips to Mexico, to Ohio, because she had a brother in Ohio and his family. He had five girls in his family, too.
I've heard stories about those five girls in that family from your brother, Paul.
Oh? Well, of course, he was the only male around when we visited them, and he didn't like all their attention, thank you.
Well, his story that I recall is that they used to play spin the bottle.
Oh, yes. And he was not one that would play spin the bottle with anyone. Spin the bottle is where they would sit in a circle, and then the bottle would spin in the middle, and wherever it pointed to, and if you were the one that spun it, you had to go kiss that person. So he thought that was probably the very bad thing to do.
And since he was the only boy in a group of, with you there, six girls, he must have gotten kissed a lot in Spin the Bottle.
Well, he soon decided to go play another game. He didn't continue spinning the bottle very long at all.
Well, the story that he told was that one time you all were headed back from Ohio, and he got out at a gas station to use the bathroom. And while he was out using the bathroom, somehow in the head count he was missed. And so the car and the trailer took off with him still there at the gas station. And he was there by himself for about an hour and a half.
And those were the days when they didn't have any way to communicate with the car that was going on without the boy.
And what he said about it was that he wasn't necessarily that scared when he was waiting all alone at the gas station. He was actually a little bit relieved because there were no girls around to play spin the bottle.
Well, we were on our way back at that time from Ohio to Kansas, so the cousins were not with us at that time. It was just family. So it was, I think there was maybe another aunt in the car or something like that, because my father wasn't on that trip. And that's the only time I think we ever went back and we ever even were around with the cousins that lived in Ohio. So through the years, we've kind of lost track of all of them.
You've kept in track with a lot of your relatives that live in Colorado and Kansas.
Well, yes, you try, and it's easier now when you have computers that help you, and you keep records better than you did. It really makes you realize that back in the times before computers, by writing letters to one another, that was their means of long-distance communication. And once they'd get a letter, they would keep that for the address to give a letter in return. It was communication, it was slow moving, but it replaced all the databases that we have now, trying to keep track of where people are and what their connection things are, telephone or internet or whatever.
Oh, so a letter that came in the mail was a very precious thing.
Very precious. And it's amazing from when you study the letters that were in the very early days of Pony Express, they were very precious because sometimes the Pony Express could not get through, of course. They didn't live to get to the next station, so letters would not always get through. It makes you realize how privileged we are to have our kind of communication.
Well, when you think about your childhood, you know, you think back and you go, oh, this was a day that I was so happy for what was happening that day and my part in it. Is there anything that stands out?
Of course, there's always excitement of Christmas.
What was Christmas like for you?
Well, it was very simple. There were a couple of really big surprises as I was growing up when I was probably in just first or second or third grade. My father decided he'd make a puppet stage. I didn't know anything about it at all until Christmas morning. When I got up and went out there, under the tree was this big trunk like they used to use for traveling, where they'd pack everything, a very big trunk, like at least as wide as you can stretch your hands out, and as far as tall, it would be almost as tall as your waistline. It was a big, big trunk. So not sure what it was all about, but they said, all right, unlatch it, because trunks usually had two or three latches, and you'd unlatch it. And when you started opening it up, it was amazing, because he turned all the interior parts into a stage. And then the sides would go up, and that was the stage that the puppets, then he had a little bench that would go behind it, and you could stand on the bench, and you put your puppets over on the stage, and it was a puppet stage, and it was all packed into that trunk.
Had your dad made that?
Oh, yes. He just had gone out and bought a very old trunk, what they used to call a steamer trunk, which was a big, big trunk, bigger than you'd probably have ever seen. It was an amazing thing to see it all come together as a stage for puppets.
You know, that sounds a little bit like over in Lynchburg, there's a place called the Red Barn that's a museum for an artist and maker of things named Lester Raymer.
Lester Raymer.
Do you think that your dad knew Lester Raymer?
No, I don't think he did. My mother knew of Lester Raymer because when I was quite young, just beginning high school, I think, no, maybe even earlier than that, in junior high, she had gathered in some of the friends that I had and asked their parents if they could go with us to go to Lynchburg, because she had heard of
Burger Sanzen.
Sanzen, mm-hmm. She arranged, she called ahead, and she made an appointment with him. And he was a very famous artist, even in those days. And he was so courteous to those of us that were youngsters. There must have been about six of us in the group. He would take us through his entire studio and tell us about how different paints were done and how he'd started painting. Lynchburg was a Swedish settlement. It was a beautiful little place to go to. I've been back there as an adult several times now, but I don't think my father was ever over to the Red Barn. I don't think we even purchased anything from the Red Barn until Lee and I were married.
Well, and the Red Barn was Lester Raymer's studio. Well, you have a stained glass piece by Lester Raymer. You have a lot of concrete statues by Lester Raymer. And he was a wonderful artist, and he made things like puppet stages.
Oh, yes.
And puppets.
And he was especially intrigued by puppets because they have such charm. And I think in Europe, they used puppets for so many years to put on performances for children that they were beloved things. So one time when I was in the studio, Lester Raymer, with my husband, with Lee, we had looked through the studio and visited with Mr. Raymer at that time, and I saw that he had a table, and he had beautiful pieces of glass all laid out in the pattern of St. Francis of Assisi. I thought it was lovely, and I asked him, is that going to be finished, and when will it be ready for sale? And he said, no, I'm never going to finish that. I've given up on it. And he turned and kind of walked away, and I said, how can that be? Because it's a beautiful piece. You have it all ready to go. He said, you have to take stained glass and put it together with lead between the pieces. And he said, I'm never going to take that time to do it. And so we went out of the room, and we went to lunch in Lindsberg. And as I was sitting down at lunch, I suddenly realized how to save his piece. So I said, let's go back to Lester Raymer's studio, because I think I can tell him how that piece can be put back together. So Mr. Raymer was a little doubtful, but he listened to me. I said, if you would put a piece of glass, plain glass, and put a frame, you don't put the frame all the way around the whole thing, but you lay your pieces of stained glass on top of the plain glass, and then you can, instead of putting lead between it, you can paint where the cracks are on the glass so it looks like it's leaded. It looks like it's been leaded between each piece. Then when you're finished with that, you put another piece of glass on top of it, so it's a sandwiching between the two pieces of glass. And then you put the metal frame around all those pieces of glass so that it keeps it all together and safe. And I said, where did you find those pieces of glass? He said, a friend of mine from Europe, a church was damaged during the war, and these were pieces of glass that came out of a church that no one could use. And they shipped them to me from Europe, a friend of his, and he said he'd worked with them for a long, long time till he got the whole St. Francis motif. And so he said, I'd given up on it until you said what you did. And so when I went back, he let us buy it, and it was finished. And he had done exactly that. He'd put the dark color that makes it look like leaded glass between each piece.
He must have been so happy because you helped him solve the problem and get it done.
Well, it was such a thing of beauty, the idea of him in fact, he would break it up and use it for other things, for color. But he had worked so hard just to get it into that form. But you say it's mine, but what you don't realize, it belongs to Walter Schlender, because at one time I asked grandchildren to please pick out something in the house that they would like to have eventually. And I put sticker on the thing that they would like to have, and that's Walter Schlender's. When he gets a house where he feels it's safe to have it, he can take it with him and put it in his house.
Well, he and everybody else will like to know the story of how you helped save that piece. And I'm thinking that I didn't realize how much in someone like Lester Raymer you saw some aspects of your dad.
Well, I think my mother saw a lot of that, probably more than I made that connection. My father never did anything what I'd call artistic, in a sense. He did create like shadow portraits, which was kind of unusual. So we have shadow portraits of the family, including the dog one time in the shadow portrait. But he never did anything on the Dillon side of the family. His youngest sister thought she was an artist, but she really wasn't. In fact, she lived with us for about a year, and it didn't work out. But just saying, there wasn't any art that I ever saw from that side of the family, as far as what you'd consider to be something like Lester Raymer's art.
And yet it sounds like that puppet stage that your dad made was beautiful.
It was, and it was functional. It was a creative thing, and just the idea of it all fitted into that trunk, and like it's like a jigsaw puzzle getting put together, that part intrigued him. And I'm sure my mother, he would probably be involved in that. She suggested, what could you make that would be something that would be very special? She was the one that liked to put on shows, and she and her sisters would put on lots of shows. She even did Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs down in our lower level, and had all the stage pieces for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and our neighbors were, then I was one of the Seven Dwarfs.
You weren't very tall at that point.
No, the ones from junior high and high school were the ones that were Snow White and all that, but we practiced for a long time on that one.
Well, and so the puppet stage was your first chance to be in the theater yourself.
Well, yes, because you have to act out all puppets. They don't, you have to move them and you have to know what you're going to do as far as the story goes. And so it is, it's a completely different thing than just reading a book.
That sounds like that made for a lot of happy hours, is working with that puppet stage.
Well, I think I still have some of the puppets. When you go to Kansas, and did you know that your sister, Stephanie, has created what she calls the museum? She has put in that, I think there are three puppets that I see in that, and I'm not sure that they all go back to that time that I had that stage, but she's picked up things that were left around by everyone and had outgrown, things that had memories to them, and they're in there. There's certain dresses, and there's certain things that are just what she thought were a museum piece.
You know, I'm thinking that the puppets were wooden puppets, and they had very simple arms and legs, maybe even stick wood arms and legs and hinges, but the faces were big wooden round faces with paint on them.
Well, yes, each puppet was a little different, and so depend on the artist that created the puppet. I don't think we'd never made our own puppets. As you say, it has to be made so that it looks real, and if you try to put it together yourself, it looks kind of clunky. So I never made a puppet.
Now, you said that that was one really wonderful Christmas, that you discovered that puppet stage underneath the Christmas tree. And then you said there might have been another especially sparkly Christmas.
Well, I think they were always very careful to make it a special. We didn't do a lot of decoration as far as tree and all of that, because people go to such extremes these years. In fact, I think we only had a very few lights for our trees, and it was not a big, big affair like it seems to be anymore. I think it's gotten too much promoted by the storekeepers. But anyway, there was one Christmas when I was quite a bit younger when my Aunt Betty, my Uncle John's wife, and I hadn't known that she would even knew I was carrying a doll around, and I must have been all of 4 years old. She had carefully taken measurements of that doll, and she made a whole set of clothes for the doll. She hand-stitched them all herself, and she made a beautiful little blanket. That was a big surprise. It was fascinating later as I was older and realized that Betty, she was an orphan when she was very young in New York City. She was the oldest of five children, all girls, and they were put on the orphan train and sent out west, and she was the oldest.
I hate to interrupt, but we are being interrupted right now. Do you want to say what's happening?
Pippin is opening the door, and he's letting all the cold air in. And he's opened the door, and he wants to come in. And now we are going to close the door so we don't blow away here. You can hear that wind whistling.
Hey, Pippin, do you want to comment?
Betty Jones was the oldest sister, and the orphan train was something. If you can go to internet and pull up orphan train from New York, you will be amazed at what organization it took. But people in New York could see children whose parents had died. They were out on the streets trying to live and stay alive on their own, and the churches would try to help. But it seemed like it was such a terrible depression that they were having. The people and that I think it's one of the times when there was terrible flu going around and people were dying. So the churches decided there has to be some way that these children, there's no more room to put them in the orphanage. So there's one person, I'm trying to remember the name of the person, who decided that if they could get the cooperation of a railroad and be able to take the children into the West,
they put them on a train.
They had to be carefully organized. They would send messages to the West that this train will be coming through a certain schedule. People were advised by their ministers in the churches of the West that there would be children there that could be adopted.
You know, it must have been such a thing, because some of the families that would come to seek out children would be loving families looking to have a family member, and some people would be horrible people who were looking for somebody to be basically slave labor and mistreated in all kinds of ways.
But they'd tried to organize in such a way that they'd had the local ministers interview the people who were going to be coming down to the station. And there was somewhat of a decision made by the ministers whether or not this would be an acceptable family to let them adopt a child. And then they would have information about some of the children that were on the train. I don't think there was that much clarity as to the fact that maybe they were talented in certain ways or they were stronger in certain ways. So I don't know that the people going in to see the adopted children potential knew anything about who would be getting off the train.
And this would have been before the time where there were social workers and social welfare groups. So it all fell to the churches to be organizing this, it sounds like.
There was one lady in New York, as I recall, that had the concept that this would be the way to save the children. Otherwise, those children were dying. In Betty Jones's situation, the mother had died, and he'd tried to take care of those children, small children, for maybe a half a year himself, and he couldn't work and try to earn money to take care of them. And it got to be such a desperate thing that he finally said that that would be the only solution. And he told his oldest daughter, Betty, he said, "I will come and find you." And that's what he always said.
Oh, so he said, "I will come and find you." Did he?
No. So, she had to see all of her sisters line up every time and see, I don't know how she got the name of where her sisters were left or her sisters' new families, but I remember she would talk to me and tell me that she was going to find them all, and she did.
She, how much older than you was she?
I went to her after John died. She was in a home for her age in Oklahoma, and I think I went to her 80th birthday, and I think I was probably about 30 or 35 at that time. So there's 50 years difference in our age. Probably.
Well, that means that when you were old enough to hear her telling this story, she was in her 50s, and she was still trying to find her sisters.
She never drove a car, and John and Betty never had any children. John, my uncle John, my mother's brother John, married Betty. She somehow was able to get contact with the organization that had done this, and I think they traced it out well enough that she actually located every one of those four sisters. And I went with her one time when she'd found the sister that was close to where we lived in Hutchinson. I think it was in Larned, which I, at that time, I was driving. She couldn't drive. So I drove her over to where her sister was being cared for, because her sister was having, I'm not sure what it was, an emotional breakdown of some sort.
Well, Larned is where the state mental hospital is for Kansas, so was she in the hospital there?
She was under medical treatment. And Betty had not had a chance to physically see her, and I was the only way I could get her over there.
Oh, that must have been doubly hard, because she hadn't seen her sister for 50 years. And then to see her sister who was in a mental hospital.
And another of her sisters was, I wouldn't call her deformed, but she had a limp, a very severe limp. So when she'd been adopted, she could get around, but she could not be fully active like a child would be. Now, Betty was, she would go hiking with John and do a lot of things. She wasn't what you'd call an athletic person, but she had a great deal of stamina. So she could do all those things, but and they moved quite a bit because he was a stonemason, and so he was moving from town to town, from job to job, and she would make new friends in new towns and always had a personality that people liked to be around. Her picture, by the way, is downstairs.
Well, and so you went with her for finding two of her sisters?
No, I think it was only one, but I heard about the others from her. She didn't really talk. If you'd ask her, she'd tell you. I don't think I ever asked her. I think I heard my mother ask her, because my mother would ask, and I could probably hear what was being discussed between the two of them, because when she was trying to locate them. I think my mother was helpful in making the connection for her because, again, Betty didn't, she wasn't even comfortable with telephones. So I think my mother would maybe step in and do some of the telephoning for her. And so she was come and stay with us for a day, and my mother would help try to trace out what she was looking for.
Well, then, so John was your mom's brother, mm-hmm. and Betty was John's wife.
Right. Yes. So that was, as I said, the Christmas of the nice little clothes for my doll.
Mm-hmm. And that came from your Aunt Betty. Mm-hmm.
She liked to do handiwork. They were never things of great beauty, but she would put a lot of time and effort into making them look nice, you know, and she always things that she had made herself.
She liked to send you for Christmas, even when we were growing up, kitchen towels where she crocheted a top on it so that you could hang it on the refrigerator.
Oh, yes. It was all very carefully thought through. But she liked to keep herself busy. She was a good cook. My mother let Paul and I go and visit them like a weekend, and John would take us fishing. I wasn't wild about fishing, but...
Are you sure you didn't catch those catfish by putting your hand in their mouths?
No, John would not have wanted me to go in with get in with the fish. He probably wouldn't have permitted that.
Well, they sound like they were a special part of your growing up.
Since they didn't have a family of their own, they liked to have Paul and I go with them and have those kind of adventures. So it was a nice thing for us as well as, I think, for them. The other uncles were a lot like John. They liked to have you involved with them and what they were doing, but they didn't spend as much time with us as John and Betty did. And then my Aunt Julia, who lived just a block away, and her daughter, she only has one daughter, Barbara, she was a little bit hard for the rest of the family to get along with. She was a little bit critical of people and not too generous. She just was not as thoughtful as John was. Mm-hmm.
John was quieter, and he and Betty were more observant in a kindly way.
Mm-hmm. I think you children met John one time when I took you to Colorado Springs, and they had a very nice little kind of landscape trailer place where they had their flowers. And did he have a dog at that time? He usually had a dog, and he taught the dog all kinds of interesting tricks.
Well, it was a very tree-filled trailer park, lots of trees, and they had a big Wurlitzer organ in their trailer house. And the best thing of all is that Chase was maybe 3 years old. And John, who was this very skinny guy, showed Chase how he could take his thumb and blow on his thumb, and it would make a balloon pop up in his arm.
It was a muscle he was popping. Well, that was making his arm look like it popped up, yes.
And so he did that several times, and Chase tried to do it, and Chase couldn't do it the way that Uncle John could.
That's true. But John and Betty always liked to be with children, and they knew things that they could do that amused children. I'm glad that you all had a chance to see them. Anyway, that's, as I said, some surprises that came along as far as memories.
Now, I know that we shouldn't talk a lot about pets, but you had a big orange cat named what again?
Tucker. And the other one was Nip. And Paul's cat died. He was a black cat. My mother found that I had a knife in my hand and I was going toward Tuck. And she said, I don't forget how old I was at that age, but she said, what are you doing with that knife? I said, Tuck died, and I have to find out why he died, so my cat's not going to die. So he's dead, and I'm going to cut him so I can see what happened, why he died. And so she took the knife away from me. But I was going to do, I don't know how I knew about doing things like that, really, but that's the first time I ever remember having my own knife in my hand.
It must have been one of those encyclopedia articles you read.
Well, at that time, Tucker was very important to me. He was my cat, and I didn't want that same thing to happen to my cat. And as long as Nip had died, I needed to find out why that might happen to my cat. So it seemed very, very logical.
And your cat, Tucker, the gold one, lived to be nearly 20?
Oh, he was very old, and he was the one that my bedroom window was right over the glass cover to the greenhouse, and so my cat would come up and more or less knock on my screen of my window, wanting to come in or go out at night. And one night, I found that he had brought his lady friend in, and I explained to him I didn't like to have lady friends brought into my room, so I tried to discourage it. I don't know. I don't think it happened. I don't know that he got my message, but I was really surprised to wake up and find that there were two cats in my room. So a Tucker, it was a very old cat, and when I went to college, my mother actually would put him in the car and he'd go with her to wherever she was going, traveling around. He didn't like to ride in cars. He hated it, but he would go with her. Tucker had a nice adventure and lived to be a long old cat.
More than 5 minutes. Well, I think that's a good place to pause. What do you think? Is that enough for one session?
That's fine, yeah. That's fine.
Or is there something else that you want to be sure to say right now?
No, not really. I was the youngest of most of the children that were there. In fact, I'd never been around younger children. And that was the one thing that I decided I was going to do when I got to college. I was going to take whatever they had in the way of education on child development for college, for a good course that you could take.
How to study to get ready for being around little kids.
Well, when you've never been around, I've never been around babies. There were no babies that were born into the family. This is a strange thing that in that large family that you never were around, I was the youngest. Of course, I was a little spoiled probably because I was the youngest of all the families of my mother's side of the family and my father's side of the family. The one that on my father's side, his mother, his sister, Dorothy, had younger children, but they lived a long ways away. And at one time, they came and stayed with us for quite a time. And I guess I was around the younger ones then, and they were hard to be around. So maybe that's why I decided I better go take a course in child development. Something motivated that anyway. Maybe I caused people to go take their own courses in child development, as far as I know. Anyway, so that should be enough for today.